No, un mundo más justo, transmisión a transmisión.
I'm Marita Golden, writer and cultural activist, and a supporter of WPFW Radio. And you are tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Todo mi gente escuchando en Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, March 7th, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Indiana to discuss the repatriation of Mexicans during the 1930s and how it remains relevant almost a century later. During the American Great Depression almost a century ago, the United States deported, expelled, and repatriated both Mexicans and Mexican Americans, with numbers ranging from 300,000 to almost 2 million. In the years since, it has been seen as a form of institutional racism and xenophobia in the same vein as the Chinese Exclusion Act and the Bracero Program, which is why recent events merit a look back to show that anti-immigrant sentiment today is neither new nor original. And so with us on the show today is Nikki Duda, who's a freelance writer, editor, and researcher. She has an article out in Indies Times entitled, "My Family Was Almost Repatriated to Mexico in the 1930s. I See It Happening Again." Welcome back to the show, Nikki Duda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And joining us for the first time is Emiliano Aguilar, who's a political and labor historian and assistant professor in the history department at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Welcome to the show, Emiliano Aguilar.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we're going to go back and forth from the past to the present to explain why repatriation from the 1930s remains relevant today. So let me begin with Professor Aguilar by asking two questions. One, could you explain the Mexican repatriation of the 1930s as a means not to confuse it with the aforementioned Bracero program, which is a totally different issue, but equally important as well? And two, how does the state of Indiana serve as the best backdrop to explain the institutional racism behind the repatriations? Again, this was nationwide, but Indiana in particular serves as a special backdrop, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So repatriation movement, thinking quite literally, repatriation or the act of repatriating to send someone back to their own country is really a contested word for this decade of betrayal, as two historians, Francisco Valderrama, Raymond Rodriguez, call this period that coincides with the Great Depression. So we think of repatriation movement as this quote unquote voluntary return of Mexicans from 1929 to 1939. And while the numbers are really contested, right, anywhere ranging from 300,000 to 2 million, depending on the source, the key takeaway from this is that something that's described as a voluntary movement of folks from their new homes or from their areas, their environments, their residencies in the United States back to Mexico is quite conflated. Many of these were themselves actually American citizens. And thinking about Indiana in particular, it lets us see how one particular generation, sort of this first generation born of immigrant parents, are sent home, are threatened to be sent home, threatened to be sent to Mexico, I should say. Their home is the United States during a period where non-Mexicans, non-Latinos are viewing the Mexican as an economic threat. They're taking their jobs. This is a moment of economic precarity that many folks are trying to solve, right? How do we fix the Great Depression? And in the Indiana context, we see a group, the American Legion, and their commander, Paul Kelly, really take it upon themselves to do so. They solicit funds from places like Inland Steel, the very company that recruited Mexicans as strikebreakers in 1919 during the Great Steel Strike, now provide money to send Mexicans to Mexico and Mexican Americans to Mexico. So Indiana becomes quite a neat way to complicate this idea of this being voluntary, while also complicating the idea that, you know, this is done federal government down, and really highlighting the grassroots efforts of quite literally like very xenophobic actions within a community.
We can easily have this conversation with regards to border states like Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California. But in the case of the state of Indiana, we may be focusing mostly on the north side of Indiana, East Chicago, places like Gary, that part of the region there in the state of Indiana. But as we said before, this was nationwide. And you mentioned a very important issue right there, which is strike breaking, which we will hit upon further during the course of this conversation. But Nikki, as I mentioned, you recently wrote an article for In These Times about your family connection to the repatriation of the 1930s. I wonder if you could give us a few details of your family history that you believe run parallel to recent anti-immigrant sentiment here in the U.S. It's a sweeping question, I know, but again, we are living in a time not only of anti-immigrant sentiment, but also sort of a moment of anti-history as well, that there's not enough emphasis that what's happening, as I said before, is neither new nor original.
Sure. So a few summers ago, my grandmother passed away. She was born and raised, lived her entire life in East Chicago. And my mom was also born there and grew up there. And so after she passed, my mom and I went to the East Chicago Public Library because they have a room there that Emiliano knows, I'm sure, with a great local historian, Susana Bursic, and a lot of cool primary documents and old microfilms and stuff like that. And we were thinking we would go see if we could find a picture of my grandma's old apartment building in the harbor, which is the neighborhood that we're talking about in East Chicago. And we couldn't find that, but Susana handed us a book called Harbor Lights, Mexican American Harbor Lights. And she said, look up your family's last name in the back. Maybe there's something there, because my mom's grandfather worked in the mills. Her dad worked in the mills. Yeah. So she looked up their last name. She looked up Lopez, and there was a story written by one of my grandma's sisters, an essay talking about this moment where the family almost left. So my grandma would have been about 2 years old And I had never heard this story. And it was shocking to me because I knew about this. I knew about the repatriation movement and we had never been told about it. So it kind of, one of my older aunts knew, I think, which I mentioned in the article, but it kind of highlighted this shame that was associated with that time of like being the other, having your neighbors turn against you, having people pressuring you to leave, having people not want to live in the neighborhood where they work, which we'll talk about later with the Walker Report, because you're there, because you're making the neighborhood bad, you're making it dirty, you're bringing syphilis into the community, you're bringing crime and all these other things, which obviously are not true and have some nativist and xenophobic elements. Of course, our family on that side has always been very proud of their heritage and at the same time has this desire to appear very American, this desire to, yeah, not to be identified with anything immigrant, which maybe someone who hears that will get upset that I said that, but that's neither here nor there. And so it kind of illuminated the why there. And it kind of also illuminated what people are going through right now and how that's going to affect future generations growing up, how it's going to affect their relationship with their identity, how it will shape their relationship to the community, wanting to learn Spanish or not, or your name is Marcelino and you go by Mark or something like that. So yeah, and also it was in East Chicago, it was maybe up to, correct me if I'm wrong, Emiliano, but maybe like 2,000 to 2,500 families who were affected, or not families, people, and many more in Chicago. And when I shared this article on social media, I had someone who I've known since first grade, who is also Mexican-American, wrote me and said, hey, that happened to my family and they did go back. And then my grandparents had to immigrate again later, that he has a great aunt who is a U.S. citizen who went back and lived the rest of her life in Mexico. Like it totally shifted the course of his family's history and broke their ties with the United States, even though they had this daughter who was born an American. And in the harbor, there were, you know, baseball teams. I know my grandpa played on a baseball team in the harbor and they were like engaged in all these very traditionally American activities, and that, yeah, that their neighbors didn't see it that way and saw them as an other, which in a lot of ways had to do with this strike as well as good old fashioned racism.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up this issue of the desire to be American or be more American, as you said, because I sort of had that feeling that that was something underlying the institutional racism that is not only mentioned in your article for In These Times, but also in a few articles that Professor Aguilar wrote in Belt Magazine, that this was mentioned in passing, which is not only discovering this family information, but the difficulties of finding this information as well. So I guess my question is here is that did this institutional racism that both of you have spoken about, and Professor Aguilar, you can answer this as well, also extended to even record keeping with regards to people not trying to associate themselves with being Mexican or hiding their last names or hiding the fact that they speak another language? Because I felt like doing my research with regards to this issue before today's interview, this was something that was also underlying the fact that this is not as covered as often as it should. And to what I said earlier, which is this moment of anti-history that we're living in, Professor Aguilar.
Absolutely. Institutional racism and this intersection or this impact on record keeping, I mean, becomes a very key bit on why early Latino history in particular becomes so difficult to document, right? The fact that with the exception of this particular moment of repatriation, Latinos aren't even a census category well until the 70s and 80s, right? Where we start to see the rise of the Hispanic. And so much of it becomes even like what we know of 1930 is tied inherently to wanting to exclude the Mexican. And in this exclusion, we sort of see a want, a desire to hide identities wherever possible, right? In East Chicago, one of the really great examples of this is Greg Estelle, who was a lawyer, but by that name alone, you would never have guessed he's a Latino, right? That he purposely changes his name. He's white passing. He gets to live in the north side of East Chicago away from the early colony that, like Nikki mentioned, one of the densest concentrations of Mexicans in the United States. Thousands of folks within this one square mile, estimated of about 5,000. And Estelle and his family get to live outside of that because of his white passing, because of this change of the name. And it affords him, as well as his like middle class professional background as a lawyer, a degree of protection during this moment. He and his family have this degree of protection because of that. And then in terms of like just keeping the records, the repatriation movement, Chicago crafts sort of these lists that we'll talk about here in a bit, these lists that let the American Legion in particular keep track of who's Mexican, how many Mexicans are living, where are they in a particular residence, what they do for work, are they on welfare or not, how many children do they have, who, what are those children's names. It becomes a really, I described it to Nikki, haunting document, a primary source to have been left behind, this record that both gives us an opportunity to see how vibrant this community was, but also the precarity of their situation, that knowing that we only know this information because this dedicated cohort of American Legion members wanted to subsequently repatriate or really just deport these families of mixed status too.
So going back to Nikki, considering what Professor Aguilar just mentioned, can you tell us, once you discovered this information about your family history, how difficult was it afterwards to try to make these connections afterwards of this moment in history?
Yeah. So one of my great aunts, had my grandma's youngest sister, had written an essay that was part of this collection created by women from the neighborhood. And in it, she mentions that they were going to be sent, quote unquote, back to Mexico because my great grandparents were immigrated and all of their kids were born in the United States, in Kansas and in Indiana. And so from her essay, it was pretty clear what was going on. And we were able to talk to Susanna about it over at the library. And it kind of highlights a lot of what, like you guys are saying, what mixed status families are worried about going through today, because you have the Holman or whatever his name is, the border czar, saying, oh, if it comes to it, instead of separating families, we'll just deport them all together. And we kind of like to act like that's this absurd thing and that couldn't be done and you can't deport U.S. citizens, but that's happened in the past. Even if it's been in a way of like the community pushing people out, or if it's been in an official capacity, that's something that's happened. And so, yeah, we were able to find out more about that, but it wasn't like nobody in the family knew anything else. So it became a kind of trying to see if we could find some kind of paper trail, trying to learn more about when my great-grandparents came to East Chicago and all that. Because like I said, my grandma had already passed. We couldn't ask her.
I really appreciate you sharing this family history as well, because the audience needs to understand that when it comes to the great immigration debate in this country, oftentimes it refers to the Latino community in the East Coast, in the West Coast, on border states, but not much is said often as it should with regards to Latinos in the Midwest, which is why we're also having this conversation today. Now, in addition to racism and xenophobia, other underlying issues fueling anti-immigrant sentiment, which Nikki kind of alluded to already, includes economic uncertainty, jobs, lack of affordable housing, even migrant labor exploitation. So for example, Professor Aguilar wrote an article in Belt Magazine in 2021 entitled East Chicago's Failed Utopian Visions, which went into detail on something called the Walker Report. So without making this sound like a loaded question, you know, what was the Walker Report? Because I'll tell you this right now, to pull back the curtain, before we started recording, I thought to myself, this sounds very Project 2025, but please describe it to us.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Walker Report, named for Chicago consulting engineer James Walker, is the study that East Chicago had done in the 1920s as they're trying to really develop who they want to be as a city. This is a moment of boosterism, of industrialization. Northwest Indiana, considered the last frontier of Indiana, is starting to develop and industrialize. It's attracting Chicago businessmen, investors, and industries over the state line to develop these sprawling industrial metropolis, industrial parks. And East Chicago sees itself as the opportunity to become this city on the lake, 100,000 people. And they're quickly thrown off. Well, why is our population stagnating? Why aren't we growing and becoming this industrial utopia on Lakefront Michigan? So upon hiring James Walker, Walker and his associates do a survey of 10,000 industrial workers, extensive research project by any means, right, in any era, and they're questioning folks after their shifts, why don't you live in East Chicago? Why will you work in this city but not live here? And from those 10,000, a quarter of the respondents cite that they refuse to live in East Chicago because of its foreigner, Black, and Mexican presence. That they are directly citing these three elements in order of responses. It's, you know, they're citing Black East Chicagoans being the main reason, Mexicans, and then foreigners. These are the reasons why they choose to live elsewhere in what were then more ethnically European or native-born, quote-unquote, American cities in places like Hammond and parts of Gary, particularly east side of Gary, Indiana, neighboring cities, as well as Whiting, which is overwhelmingly, at this time, ethnic Eastern European. So they're choosing to live elsewhere because of East Chicago's racialized population. And Walker tells the city directly that to solve this, there's two solutions. You could just build new parts of the city that exclude directly these elements, or you could slowly start to add in restrictive covenants, ban these communities from buying homes outside of neighborhoods and contain them just where they are, which is sort of one of the reasons why we see such a densely concentrated Mexican community in the harbor, like Nikki wrote about. Again, 5,000 in a square mile, like that is a ridiculous, when you think about its size. There's stories that both James Walker and his associates, but also University of California labor economist Paul S. Taylor, who did a study about Mexican labor in the early 20th century, a multi-volume study, notes that there's occasions of 16 plus people living in the same apartment because of the swing shift that, you know, four of us will sleep here for these 6 hours while you 12 are gone, and then just continually rotate through a four-person cycle, which is mind-boggling to think of how densely concentrated this community was.
And to a certain degree, how it still remains almost a century later as well. Nikki, going back to your In These Times article, further focusing on the issue of jobs, can you tell us about your family history as it pertains to migrant labor exploitation as a means to pit one group of workers with, quote, Black and Mexican laborers? Because I see that this was something that was in the middle of your article that also caught my attention and also gives people a better understanding of the neighborhood tension in this part of Indiana at the time as well.
So when I started looking into this history, into my family history, I also started to look for more information about my grandmother's parents because, yeah, we never knew much about them. My grandma wouldn't go back and forth to Mexico the way that my grandfather would. So we didn't have much of a connection with that side other than the people who are already in the United States. And so when I started looking into her father's life, especially, all I knew about him was that he arrived as a kid, according to my grandma, and that I couldn't find any record of his entry. But one of my aunts had told me that she found his old draft card for World War I. And so as I'm like doing research online, I found a copy of it on Ancestry or something. And it shows that when he was about 25, he was in Taylor Springs, Illinois, which isn't too far from Chicago, but he was out there working as a smelter. And so I did some research into Taylor Springs, and it today is a Superfund site, as is East Chicago, as is Caney, Kansas, which is another place that he went on to work as a zinc smelter. And so it kind of underlines the kind of work that these people were doing. They were doing dangerous jobs, things that could have poisoned them, that could have killed them. Chicago, early on, the mills had a pretty horrible industrial accident rate. I'm sure that goes past those early years as well. And so when he came up to work in the mills, maybe that felt like something of a step up, but they came up in 1920, and that was a year after the steel strike had begun, which was already over by the time that they got there. But the early members of the community that formed in the harbor, I mean, yeah, there were some Mexicans already living in the neighborhood or in the area, but the people who formed that early colonia were people who were brought in as scabs to break the strike. So it was Black and Mexican workers. And seemed like a lot of people were kind of told that it was a regular job offer, not that they were being brought in as scabs to cross a picket line. But it kind of laid an even stronger foundation for racial tensions in that neighborhood, because you had these white and also European migrant workers from the mill who were organized and who were trying to get concessions from Inland Steel and these other factories or these other mills. And then you had these people who are coming in who are willing to cross a picket line. Whether or not they know that that's what they're doing is, you know, up for debate, but also they're in a different situation. So, you know, you can't really blame them for that, but it's kind of the start of these fomenting tensions in the neighborhood. And yeah, so my grandma wasn't born until 1930, but she would tell me that when she was growing up during the Depression, that older European migrant people would stop her in the street and say, "Hey, you little Mexican," and, like, you know, really? Be mean to her, basically be racist to her, even when she was a small kid. So it, like, lingered for years after that, I think.
Really?
Yeah, because these people were living, like, their landlord was Polish. They were living on top of each other. They were living as neighbors. But there was, yeah, even though they were in this migrant neighborhood, there was still this underlying kind of, like, distrust because of that history, especially.
Again, I appreciate you sharing your family history as well. And thank you as well for pointing out the health hazards of working in these industries as well. Because if workers during that time weren't developing health issues through the exposure of chemicals and metals, they most certainly would have been maimed or injured by working in those type of industries as well at the same time. And that feels like an hour-long conversation in and of itself as well, which goes to show you once again that migrant labor exploitation is neither new nor original, once again, in this country. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Nikki Duda, who's a freelance writer, editor, and researcher, and Emiliano Aguilar, who's a political and labor historian, as well as an assistant professor in the history department at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. Was Los Tigres del Norte, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about repatriation of the 1930s with Nikki Duda, who's a freelance writer, editor, and researcher, and Emiliano Aguilar, who's a political and labor historian and assistant professor in the history department at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. So how do we tie everything, Nikki, considering everything that we've discussed thus far, to the rise of right-wing xenophobia, to the economic downturn worldwide? Well, Kristi Noem, the current Secretary of Homeland Security and known Christian white nationalist, created an ad that is running on social media and radio stations worldwide. And just to give you an idea of what we're talking about with regards to recent times, let's take a listen.
I'm Kristi Noem, the United States Secretary of Homeland Security. Thank you, President Donald J. Trump, for securing our border and putting America first. Let me deliver a message from President Trump to the world. If you are considering entering America illegally, don't even think about it. Let me be clear. If you come to our country and you break our laws, we will hunt you down. Criminals are not welcome in the United States. For too long, weak leadership has left our borders wide open, flooding our communities with drugs, human trafficking, and violent criminals. Well, those days are over. Under President Trump, we are defending American families and restoring their safety. If you try to enter illegally, you will be caught. You will be removed, and you will never return. Follow the law, and you'll find opportunity. If you break it, you'll find consequences. Strong borders mean a stronger America. President Trump is making America safe again.
So that's Kristi Noem running an ad that could have, I guess, easily been placed in the same time period in the 1930s, if you think about it. And I just want to say this as a sidebar, that in addition to repatriations, the deportations of millions of Mexicans out of the country, this was also happening at the same time as Prohibition, which gives you sort of an idea of the sort of puritanical time period that the United States was living in. But Nikki, going back to the question here, how does the modern means of communication sort of make this global right-wing anti-immigrant shift even worse? Because I have to tell you that what we just heard right there, the video that corresponds with it, is even worse. And it gives credence to what you wrote in your article of how everything that we've discussed sort of lends itself to what we've seen worldwide with this xenophobic anti-immigrant sentiment worldwide by the right wing.
So that was, that was also definitely the case in the 30s, obviously. I mean, we all know what happened in the 30s, right? And in the United States, ahead of the repatriation movement, we had, you know, the KKK having massive influence in government and local governments and municipal governments, state governments across parts of the country, including Indiana. And you had in the early 30s, you had this German-American Bund, which was a Nazi-affiliated, pro-Nazi organization that had tons of members across the United States of German descent. And so they were able to do all of that without the internet, without contacting each other on TikTok, without organizing on Twitter or whatever it's called now. And so we're at this point today where something I don't mention in this article that I kind of regret is the amount of misinformation that is going around about migrants in general, conflating asylum seekers with undocumented migrants, conflating crime statistics, misrepresenting crime statistics to make migrant communities look a certain way.
Well, that clip that we just played is sort of a good example of what you're describing.
Yeah. But of course, so this is, you have this coming from the top down. And then at the same time, you have people, everyday people, reproducing that on social media. And which way does it actually go? I don't know if it's coming from the top down originally or if it's coming from the bottom up originally. That's anybody's guess. I also work in research around misinformation, and I work on Spanish language misinformation in particular. And so a lot of what we see are videos showing people going back, lines of people marching towards the border that are kind of supposed to conjure up images of self-deportation, of voluntary departures, right? They're not real, obviously. Like, there are no marches of tens of thousands of people going to the border. But then you have all these comments under it of, yeah, send them back, send them back, send them back. And some of that stuff has exploded, especially over the past year. And in the summer, I know, Oscar, you and I have talked about this before, but in the summer, I was in Istanbul, and at the time that a pogrom erupted against Syrian refugees living in Turkey.
Yeah.
And I was with a friend who was Syrian, and we were just, you know, scrolling social media. A list came out with all these people's names and personal information, passport photos, was leaked online. And then all of these other videos saying they're all the same things that you hear about migrants in the United States, right? That they're rapists, they're criminals, they're after our women, that they're immoral, they're uncivilized, all of these things. And with just the most heinous comments underneath. And in the weeks that followed that, a lot of Syrian people were like, that's it. And they tried to come to Europe. And then you have in Germany, so the Syrian dictatorship was ousted on December 8th, I believe, of this last year. Assad is gone. And the next day, you had Germany, Greece, Italy, I believe, and France were the four that said, okay, we're freezing applications for Syrian asylum seekers. Meanwhile, I mean, Syria is still in shambles. People are still, you know, the infrastructure is totally shot. There are landmines, not enough electricity, not enough homes still standing in some places to house people. And they're already talking about, well, we're not going to take more people here. We're not going to let more people stay. And then also in Germany this past week, you had the far right AfD party, which is very anti-migrant and by most people's accounts, white nationalist, won second place in the national elections. They won 20% of the vote. Yeah. So they won't be in the coalition government, most likely. That's what they're saying now, and that's probably not going to happen. But they still got the second most votes, and they made inroads into parts of Germany where they hadn't gotten much of the vote before. So it's kind of, you have this, again, this growth of nativism, this growth of xenophobia, of anti-migrant sentiment, that one is, you know, part of anytime there's a global economic downturn, people turn to nativism, right? They turn to me first, you got to get out of here, you're ruining the economy, and kind of the scapegoating. But then also at the same time, right now we have the internet and we have these people making contacts with each other, and we have Andrew Tate going to Romania, and we have these kind of like Elon Musk appearing at the AfD conference in Germany via Skype call or whatever that was. I don't know. He was on a video call there being like, yeah.
Horrendous.
AfD, yeah. Actively backing them. And so you have this kind of formation of a global far right, a global anti-migrant movement that honestly is really scary.
It's scary, especially when the U.S. has sort of not only influenced other countries around the world, but sort of created now sort of this blueprint that, to be quite honest, is not exclusive to this current administration. It's not exclusive to the previous administration, but it's something institutional that goes all the way back, in my opinion, as I said before, to the Chinese Exclusion Act, the Bracero Program, and the repatriation of the 1930s that we've discussed here. So, Professor Aguilar, I want to go back to the Walker Report. Could you give us your analysis about why this report that you mentioned earlier and the ideas to make East Chicago an urban utopia ultimately fail? And before you answer that, I want to premise this by sort of quoting you in the article that you wrote for Belt Magazine with regards to this failed utopia, because towards the end of this article, you said the following, quote, "It shows how industrial expansion became intertwined with a particular white vision of the city and the region. The study remains not only a roadmap to what could have been, but a crucial document highlighting the stakes of this utopia. A utopia, the nearly 10,000 people surveyed made clear, left no rooms for, quote, foreigners, Mexicans, and Blacks, end quote."
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for bringing up this piece. It's been quite fun to revisit it and to think through about the Walker Report again, especially in context and in conversation with Nikki's piece on the repatriation movement. It ultimately fails for many reasons. First, post-war era, we see a return of formerly repatriated Mexicans to East Chicago. We see a post-war booming economy as steel requires new workers, particularly during World War II, when much of their workforce is serving abroad, they hire in Tejanos. And in the 1947 and 1950s, from there on, increasingly Puerto Ricans. And this becomes an overwhelmingly Latino city. And as folks see this, in 1950, the height of East Chicago's population, it begins to dwindle from there on out. White flight, suburbanization in what's Ridge Road, which used to be a cutoff between sort of the very urbanized part of Northwest Indiana and the very like rural part of Northwest Indiana, is building suburbs along these communities in communities like Highland, Griffith, Munster. And we're seeing early causes or early cases, I should say, of white flight, of folks themselves a generation removed from their, more often than not, Eastern European, ethnically European family, parents' generation, grandparents' generation, decide now to move south in Lake County. And well, they might keep the old home and rent it out to these newcomers, whether they be migrants from Texas or Puerto Ricans, or they sell outright to them. And because their traditional colonia is undergoing an urban renewal project in the 50s, and homes are being torn down by the dozens, and like many urban renewal projects throughout the United States, not being replaced with new adequate housing, the housing stock itself dwindles and it leaves them few options. So they're moving into new neighborhoods, breaking sort of that density that we see in the 1930s. And that becomes Chicago's, I think, failure to enact this utopian vision. It becomes white flight, it becomes suburbanization, it becomes the increased migration of Latino communities, whether from Mexico, Texas, or Puerto Rico to the city, and East Chicago really leaving left with nowhere else to expand. At its height, this city is zoned 74-75% industrial land use. The actual acreage for residential homes is very small. So while you're destroying homes and not offering replacements, it's leaving communities very little to go, and they could never become then that city of 100,000 people that they imagined they could be on the shores of Lake Michigan.
Professor Aguilar, you've written several articles for Belt Magazine, but I'm going to create a link on our Twitter account to this particular article, This Failed Utopia in East Chicago, Indiana, to sort of give people a certain degree of hope with regards to everything that's going on with this negative turn of xenophobia that we've seen worldwide that Nikki mentioned. It's a certain degree of hope. And it's hard to find hope right now because the momentum that we've seen worldwide doesn't give us much room for hope at the moment. But conversations like these can go a long way, not only to educating the public, but also informing the public that this country and this world has been down this road before, and there are ways to fight back against it. So last month, for example, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did a Know Your Rights webinar for her constituents in her district. This led Trump's quote-unquote border czar, Tom Homan, to threaten her by asking the Department of Justice on television to investigate her. This incident can be seen in two ways. One, it is a direct and obvious threat to freedom of speech. It can also be seen, I guess, optimistically as a sign of an administration that is scared of an educated public, not only to their rights as citizens, but also the shaky legal ground that this current administration is standing on. So I want to ask both of you guys this question, since this is the final question, and I'll start with Professor Aguilar. What can people take from your research on this moment in history that can be translated into grassroots resistance, or at the very least better educating the public as to what to do next and how to fight back? Because again, we don't have a lot of room for optimism with everything that's going on, but educating ourselves at the very least is one form or one tool here.
Absolutely. I completely agree that education is a wonderful tool to combating both misinformation, but the very like highly performative actions we're seeing come out the White House. You played Christie's ad, but I'm also struck by the Valentine's Day card, right? That we saw the White House release on Twitter.
Oh my God. Was it like
roses are red, violets are blue, come here illegally and we'll deport you, with Trump and his border czar on this pink background, right? Like they're making a joke out of actual suffering of families and communities across the United States, suffering that in many cases, has been deliberately fabricated, right? It comes as no surprise that Chicago, long time a gateway of Latinas, Latinos traveling throughout the Midwest, right? Whether it's historically as its center of the sprawling railroad empire of the United States, that all tracks led through Chicago. And from there, Latinos ended up in Kansas City, South Bend, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, right? Is now ground zero for a highly publicized, highly performative, ridiculously expensive campaign against undocumented communities. It's taking to the waves of, I really like Nikki's point earlier, right? This is pre-internet, but now that it's in the internet, we're seeing this displayed in real time. ICE constantly posts the folks that they're detaining and arresting, what charges that they're accused of violating. More often than not, these are minor things that in some states, like a cannabis charge, wouldn't lead to an arrest anymore. So I think in framing this historically, we see the aftermath of the repatriation movement. We see the children who watched as their parents and grandparents' generation were rounded up, watched as their censuses were taken of their families, watched as their families were stripped from community welfare, return, in some cases serve, right, overseas during World War II, and return to lay down and make it clear that this can never happen again. We see a rise of mutual aid societies during this period, a community looking inward for support and recognizing that some of the best support to have while having very few leaders nationally in the 1930s, unlike now with, yeah, AOC's wonderful Know Your Rights going live campaign, or wonderful online webinar, I should say, about Know Your Rights. This is pre that, where these sort of organic leadership at a national level is just not present yet. I think the real strength comes from these grassroots efforts, mutual aid societies organizing, a generation that witnessed this, wanting to prevent this from ever happening again. It's a really wonderful opportunity. Nikki, I really appreciate you giving shout out to some of the great folks on the ground in Indiana, like Cosecha Indiana, in Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance, who's sort of doing this work in Indiana today as in response to these very like publicized campaigns of fear and violent campaigns of intimidation, I should say, that we're seeing in East Chicago in particular and Chicagoland.
So in addition to Professor Aguilar's article in Belt Magazine, we're also going to create a link to Nikki Duda's article for In These Times with regards to both her family history and the repatriation of Mexicans in the 1930s. So Nikki, I'll give you the final question here. What else do you hope people get from your article that needs to be understood, or what do you hope that they learn from your article here? Because like I said before, it's hard to find much degree of hope right now. But for me personally, I always find hope through enlightenment. And your article was particularly informative, educational, and at the very least, we could educate ourselves through fantastic articles like yours.
Thank you. That's very nice. I think what made me want to research this era more and to write something about it and to draw some parallels to the present is exactly that, is that we need to realize that the era that we're in right now, this is not forever. And I don't just mean it as in Trump will be in power 4 years. This is something, you know, the United States, despite the fact that most people are from somewhere else, is not a country that has historically been very friendly to immigrants, except maybe the earliest ones. And if we kind of take a step back and say, this has happened before, what worked in those situations? What kind of like Emiliano was saying with the mutual aid societies in East Chicago, and also in the essay that I found by my great aunt, she mentions that my mom's grandmother, my great grandmother, was very active in the community and in kind of helping new arrivals assimilate. So there's also this, obviously migrant communities have their own mutual aid networks and they're dealing with this constantly. So that's nothing new for them, right? And in Chicago, when these raids started, I forget the date now, but it was, I guess, early in February, maybe the end of January. There were, I guess, Dr. Phil was like along with them and yeah, live streaming the raids, and they were complaining, which I heard from someone else. I didn't watch Dr. Phil's live stream, complaining that people in Chicago were too well-educated about their rights. So they weren't able to detain as many people as they would have liked to. So, you know, Chicago has a long history of heavy immigration that has some strong and deeply rooted migrant communities, not just Latinos. And the community rose to the challenge. So people, like, this is something that people have dealt with before historically, that our communities have dealt with before. And it's just something they're going to have to deal with again, unfortunately. But it doesn't mean that the only outcome is doom and gloom, that the only outcome is horrific. Like, there are already people and communities and organizations who are rising to the occasion and who are saying, this is not going to happen here, or I'm going to go volunteer my time, or I'm going to go do work with these communities. I'm going to help people fill out their asylum applications. I'm going to volunteer for a first response line. So if somebody sees ICE operating in my neighborhood, we can make sure that there are legal responders on the ground. All of these things. We just have to turn to the past to see that there's always an endpoint to these kinds of errors.
When I started this conversation, I asked Professor Aguilar why the state of Indiana was the best backdrop to explain the repatriation of the 1930s. And with your response right there, you show that the state of Indiana is also the best backdrop for education and enlightenment on this history and how it ties to recent events. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Emiliano Aguilar, who's a political and labor historian and assistant professor in the history department at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Professor Aguilar, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And we've also been speaking with Nikki Duda, who's a freelance writer, editor, and researcher. Her recent article in These Times is entitled, My Family Was Almost Repatriated to Mexico in the 1930s. I See It Happening Again Today. Thank you very much once again for being on the show with us, Nikki Duda.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely, you got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Please join the WPFW family as we celebrate the life of Larry Applebaum, longtime host of The Sound of Surprise. Friends, colleagues, and coworkers will gather to remember Larry and his tremendous contributions to WPFW, the Library of Congress, and the jazz world at large. Music will be provided by DC's own Paul Carr and friends. Sunday, March 23rd, beginning at 2 p.m., at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 400 I Street Southwest, Washington, D.C. For more information, please go to WPFWFM.org.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood. Visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, I'm Von Martin, host of Caribbeana here on Saturdays, 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. on WPFW. For the 48 years I've been on WPFW Radio, I do feel so humbled with the response of you, our listening audience, with your wonderful reaction to our fundraising efforts. On behalf of the staff and management and the volunteers who continue to bring you excellent programming of jazz and jazz extensions, with strong public affairs and relevant news, I say thank you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Greetings, I'm Maya Muna Youssef, and this is WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Sego, I'm John Kane, and this is Resistance Radio. I want to thank you for joining me. I got to address some myths this week. You know, a lot of times I tell people history and that kind of stuff, but, you know, the thing is that people have a perception of what a Native person is